This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Friday, August 21st. I'm Eric Latch, staff writer at The New Yorker, filling in for Dorothy Wickenden.
I'm a proud Democrat, and I'll be proud to carry the banner of our party into the general election. So it's with great honor and humility, I accept this nomination for President of the United States of America.
Last night, Joe Biden formally accepted the Democratic nomination for president at the party's virtual convention, bringing to close the Democrats' long primary season. The convention assembled a starry but unusual group of political figures, past White House occupants like the Clintons and the Obamas, progressives like Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and even Republicans like John Kasich and Colin Powell, who have temporarily defected from their party to support Biden. Together, they pitched a message of unity, even if it was only a temporary one, with the goal of unseating Donald Trump. John Cassidy, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss whether or not the convention succeeded on the terms it set for itself, the benefits and drawbacks of its virtual format, and what to expect from next week's Republican National Convention. John, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Eric. Delighted to be here.
Conventions traditionally are used by parties to showcase the strengths that they want to project to the electorate going into the general election. In particular this year, the Democrats seem to be wanting to show us the big tent that they've assembled to take on Donald Trump in the fall. We heard from Bernie Sanders, who made a sort of emphatic pitch for why his supporters should back Biden.
Our campaign ended several months ago, but our movement continues and is getting stronger every day. Many of the ideas we fought for that just a few years ago were considered radical are now mainstream. But let us be clear, if Donald Trump is reelected, all the progress we have made will be in jeopardy.
John, what did you think of Sanders' speech and his role and the role of the left at this convention?
Well, I think when historians look back on this, they'll see Bernie's speech on the opening night as one of the two or three most important speeches of the entire convention. I mean, the entire sort of aim the Democrats had was to keep the momentum going. They're ahead in the polls. They know that. Biden, look, if things carry on as they have been doing for the last 6 months, Biden will be president. What can go wrong? One of the things that can go wrong is that he stumbles. And obviously, we've got to deal with that. But the other one is back to 2016. You have a schism in the party. The progressive vote doesn't turn out in large numbers. Bernie, I think, almost single-handedly dealt with that potential problem. It really was a pretty astonishing speech, I thought. I mean, he was basically making the 1930s argument for a popular front against a sort of incipient fascist regime. And I think that was very powerful. And the you've got to give the campaign, the Biden campaign, some credit here. They reached out to Bernie immediately after Biden wrapped up the nomination. They set up this joint task force to write a program, which actually, if you look at the program they put out and you look at the official Democratic platform, which was voted through at the convention, they're very similar. But I think the convention from that perspective was the sort of culmination of a months-long process to try and mend the divides. As I think you wrote, it's not a permanent peace treaty. And in fact, Bernie himself said in an interview just before the convention that the day after Biden's elected, he'll start campaigning again for a progressive agenda. But
right,
the fact that they've agreed to, you know, unite forces until November 3rd is very significant, I think. And that was the image that the Democrats wanted to put out on the first day of the convention, and they succeeded.
And so on the flip side from Sanders, you have a number of notable Republicans, maybe principally John Kasich, the former governor of Ohio, who got tapped to speak this week, you know, as well, and provide kind of endorsement of Biden from the other side of the political spectrum.
I'm a lifelong Republican, but that attachment holds second place to my responsibility to my country. That's why I've chosen to appear at this convention. In normal times, something like this would probably never happen. But these are not normal times.
How effective or not did you think the presence of Kasich and other Republicans were this week?
I mean, I think it's pretty effective. I know it outrages a lot of progressives and ardent Democrats to have these Republicans speaking there. I mean, it is obviously sort of provocative to give Kasich 5 to 10 minutes, wherever he got, and AOC only got 1 minute. I think AOC should have been given a bigger platform. But I think it's entirely legitimate to put members of the president's own party out there saying that they won't vote for him, even though some of them are never Trumpers going back to 2016. Again, this is the point at which the campaign flips from just motivating Democrats to also appealing across party lines. And one of the central facets of the Biden campaign and the Biden platform all along is that he does have crossover appeal and can appeal to moderate Republicans, especially in the Midwest, in the states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, where, of course, Trump just edged his way to victory in 2016. You've got a guy from the Midwest there, Kasich, standing up and saying that Trump's not fit for office and that Biden himself is a moderate who will work with Republicans. I thought that was pretty effective television. Whether actually many, people, swing voters who can be won over, that's another question.
I thought actually one of the most interesting kind of political arguments made by a speaker at the convention this week was Andrew Yang, who ran as a Democrat in the primaries, but was a sort of first-time candidate, first-time politician. And he made this pitch about Biden saying, Biden's the guy, whatever he supports turns into normal.
The magic of Joe Biden is that everything he does becomes the new reasonable. If he comes with an ambitious plan to address climate change, all of a sudden, everyone's going to follow his lead.
I thought that was actually kind of a pretty interesting observation by Yang. If Biden actually wins, like looking ahead to sort of how a Biden administration might work, that potentially is a pretty powerful dynamic.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, it's a clever argument, obviously, that he does normalize these things. And he has clearly shifted to the left on some important issues, not others, not Medicare for all, not fracking, not defunding the police. But the sort of core economic policies, raising taxes on the rich, big public investments, particularly in tackling climate change, universal pre-K, expansion of the public option, increasing the minimum wage to $15, big push to make it easier for labor unions to organize. If you put all that together, it is a pretty progressive platform. And the other thing which Yang didn't point out, but I think is also crucial, if Biden does win, the key issue is going to be how big a majority, or if they have a majority in Congress. What decides ultimately how progressive Democratic presidents are is often not their personal prejudices or beliefs, but how much power the Democrats have in Congress. Lyndon Johnson was no progressive, but because he had majorities in the House and the Senate, he was able to do, hugely important things.
And that was an argument the Biden campaign has been making, even when in the primary season, when things looked rough for him. Part of their case was Biden at the top of the ticket helps Democrat Senate candidates in Arizona's and in Maine's, and in places that Democrats need to win if they're going to flip the Senate.
And that's why a lot of the moderates in Congress and in these swing states, were more supportive of Biden than congressmen and progressives in the big urban areas.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So you had both Barack and Michelle Obama speak this week, and their speeches were some of the most highly anticipated of the convention. In part because both of them have kept a relatively low profile, both during Trump's administration and during the Democratic primaries. But then this week, you know, we saw them both step in to current day politics in a pretty forceful way.
So let me be as honest and clear as I possibly can. Donald Trump is the wrong president for our country. He has had more than enough time to prove that he can do the job, but he is clearly in over his head. He cannot meet this moment. He simply cannot be who we need him to be for us. It is what it is.
I did hope, for the sake of our country, that Donald Trump might show some interest in taking the job seriously, that he might come to feel the weight of the office and discover some reverence for the democracy that had been placed in his care. But he never did. For close to 4 years now, he has shown no interest in putting in the work, no interest in finding common ground, no interest in using the awesome power of his office to help anyone but himself and his friends. No interest in treating the presidency as anything but one more reality show that he can use to get the attention he craves. Donald Trump hasn't grown into the job because he can't.
I mean, I thought they were very highly effective speeches from both the Obamas. And I think they did a sort of tag team on Donald Trump here. First, we had Michelle Obama give an extremely emotional and powerful speech, basically making the moral argument against Trump and saying that he basically has betrayed the essence of the country and that he just isn't fit to be president. Then Obama, former President Obama, sort of like Moses coming down from the mountain. I mean, he obviously has been criticized in a lot of areas for not criticizing Trump more in the last 3 years. I'm sure he'd make the argument that it's more effective waiting until this point when voters are watching and, you know, it's the election season. But in any case, setting that whole argument aside, I thought the key argument he made and the reason he gave the speech in around Philadelphia was that Trump's not only a bad president and an immoral president, but he's actually a serious threat to American democracy and perhaps even a mortal threat to American democracy. You know, every Democrat I know loved both speeches. Whether they have the capacity to reach across the lines and win over swing voters, I don't know.
Yeah, Michelle Obama made that, you know, in fact, they built that into her speech. She said, you know, I'm a black woman speaking at the Democratic convention. Not everybody's going to hear what I have to say.
Right, exactly. But even so, whatever the ultimate impact is, I think they, you know, they provided a great focal point for the middle part of the convention. It will be interesting to see what role Obama plays from here on in, how much, I mean, given that there are no mass meetings, it's hard for anybody to campaign. But I think, you know, the Biden campaign will be counting on Obama to, you know, for sort of get out the vote drives, even virtual ones, and perhaps for some fundraising, although they've already raised a lot of money. But I think they'll be looking to use both Obamas in any way they can.
Well, I think also, I mean, just the point I've been thinking about this week is that they're happy to draw Trump into a battle that is about comparing the Trump record and the Obama-Biden administration record.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I mean, the drawback with that until recently was the economy, which I don't think it's justified, but Trump gets better marks on handling the economy than Biden. And there's a sort of wide perception that the Obama economy was weaker than it was. But of course, the pandemic has changed everything on that. And you see in some polls, not all polls, Biden's still trailing Trump in some polls on the economy, but there have been a couple where it's flipped and Biden is now seen as the most trustworthy on the economy. So, I mean, I think that's another example of the, well, we haven't really talked about the whole pandemic, which the Democrats obviously made a big central part of the convention too, the indictment that, you know, Trump has just completely messed up the pandemic. And several of the speakers just said straight out he's responsible for, you know, 170,000 deaths or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so the next speaker I was hoping to talk about. So on Wednesday, Kamala Harris accepted the vice presidential nomination and she used the opportunity to talk not just about the pandemic, but to connect it explicitly with the, you know, mass protests and mass outcry about intractable racial injustice problems that the country is facing.
This virus It has no eyes. And yet it knows exactly how we see each other and how we treat each other. And let's be clear, there is no vaccine for racism. We've got to do the work.
What did you make of Harris and sort of this moment introducing herself to sort of a national audience in a way that she hasn't had the opportunity to do before, and in trying to bridge several of the issues that have sort of dominated the political conversation in this country the last few months?
Harris's speech was perhaps the most interesting and challenging to present of all of them. So she had to present herself and tell her story, and I thought she did that very effectively. But then at the same time, she also had to, as you say, sort of bridge the divide and not only indict Trump for his handling of the pandemic, which she did in pretty devastating fashion the week before, remember, when Biden confirmed the pick, and she gave that very trenchant speech in which she actually said straight out that he's responsible for 165,000 deaths. She also had to link it, as you say, to the sort of racial reckoning we've seen. That's just a tough ask to sort of fold all that in together in one relatively short speech. And I thought she did it pretty well. As I say, did combine a sort of personal narrative with a larger thematic sort of narrative, which combined the pandemic and the racial reckoning quite effectively, I thought.
So let's talk about Biden, who gave, you know, his speech accepting the nomination last night, Thursday night. You know, the Trump campaign has made such a big deal of trying to paint Biden as a guy who's like lost a step and who's just not going to be able to like hack it up on stage with Trump at the debates. And it seemed like the media at least was willing to entertain that idea that, like, you know, Biden, here's a guy who in his long career, you know, one of the biggest problems he's had is he sticks his foot in his mouth. But last night, I mean, that was not gaffe Joe Biden. That was like a powerful, direct message. Again, you know, like the question is sort of how broad can it reach? Who's going to listen? But still, I kind of thought that the delivery and the performance and the context and the sort of scope of the speech, he did what he needed to do up there.
I think I'd say two things on that. I basically agree with you, but I would say too, I think number one, Biden's been underestimated all along by the sort of commentariat and the political class. I'm not saying he's a great speaker. Obviously, he did pretty badly in the debates. He was pretty shaky, and this sort of raised the narrative that, you know, that he's lost his step and he's not up to it anymore. I think what he had to do in this speech was basically to show that he, you know, that he crossed that bar, that he was capable of being president, that he was capable of giving good speech under enormous pressure. And I think he did that. It was a very well-written speech. I mean, it started off with a poetry. I mean, you had that great line, "I will be an ally of the light, not the darkness."
"Here and now, I give you my word. If you entrust me with the presidency, I will draw on the best of us, not the worst. I'll be an ally of the light, not the darkness. It's time for us, for we the people, to come together. And make no mistake, united we can and will overcome this season of darkness in America."
Nobody's ever accused Biden of being a poet, even though he does quote Seamus Heaney, the Irish poet, quite a lot. He himself.
Yeah, and Yeats also.
And Yeats as well. But whoever wrote the speech gave him some poetry early on, and it sort of built up in force as the speech went on and ended in a sort of ringing critique of Trump and the argument that the country can do better and can unite, which I think is a very powerful argument. And he presented it well. I mean, it was a powerful speech, well delivered, and that's all really he needed to do.
So I want to talk about sort of looking ahead to next week and the Republican National Convention. And I think the narrative in 2016 coming out of the conventions was that the Democrats had this bright, shiny, perfectly orchestrated convention with a bunch of like celebrity cameos. And then the Republican convention was, in contrast, this kind of shabby thing. So you know, and I feel like that's the narrative that's getting set up again. In 2016, obviously, that ultimately, you know, it didn't matter. I'm wondering sort of what we're expecting from the RNC next week, but also sort of how we might expect it to sort of influence what happens in the next 2 months.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an absolutely fascinating question how the Republicans do respond to this convention, because it was a very clever production by the Democrats. It could have gone really badly because we've never had a digital online convention before, of course, but they embraced the format. That was the key to it. They didn't try and make it look like a regular convention that just happens to be online. They said, okay, we're going to exploit the technology rather than fight against it. So you had, I think, you know, some of the most powerful moments of the convention were the set pieces which exploited the sort of Zoom-like technology to go around the country. The roll call vote, I thought, was extremely powerful, showing scenes all over the country and sort of implicitly giving the message that this is a country which is much bigger and richer and more diverse and better than Donald Trump. They didn't have to say that. The images showed that. Now, in theory, there's no reason for the Republicans to not do something similar. But Trump himself is such an analog figure. He's a terrible speaker usually when he's just before a microphone. The few times when he's spoken from the Oval Office, he looks, you can tell far too easily that he's just reading from the teleprompter. Of course, they're all reading from teleprompters, but there's a skill to making it look as if you're not reading from the teleprompter. He doesn't have that. Also, I mean, the Democrats made a big effort to sort of put the regular people out there. From what we're hearing, this is going to be very much a Trump convention with all his family speaking, etc. I think it's a big challenge to make an attractive digital national convention, which is so focused on Donald Trump. You know, the Democrats, to use the cliche of the week, have raised the bar here. And if I was the Republicans, I'd be concerned.
John, thanks very much.
Thank you.
John Cassidy is a staff writer at The New Yorker. He writes a column about politics and economics for NewYorker.com and is the author of How Markets Fail, The Logic of Economic Calamities. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for NewYorker.com. I'm Eric Latch, filling in for Dorothy Wickenden.